Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. For more than 2 billion users, Facebook is a way to connect and stay connected with friends and family. The social media service also urges users to connect with more people, offering suggestions for people to friend in a list of people you may know. Senior reporter for the Special Projects Desk at Gizmodo, Kashmir Hill, decided to take a closer look at how that list is put together. Along the way, she found a family relative she never knew about, but as far as much more about how Facebook knew to connect them remains a mystery. Kashmir Hill joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann.
I've been watching that people you may know list, and it's quite out of the corner of my eye. I never really looked too deeply at it. What made you get interested in it?
Well, I've been writing and reporting on people you may know for a while now. After last year, there was somebody who told me he'd been at an anonymous meeting for parents with suicidal teens and didn't know any of the other participants.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we need to call you back. We're getting a bad connection. So if you'll just bear with us, we'll get somebody to call Kashmir Hill back right now. We're talking about that people you may know list on Facebook. If you have a question or comment about that, have you ever met anybody on the people you may know list? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out Facebook and Speaking of the Devil, and post your question or comment there. Have you ever found anybody interesting in the people you may know list in your Facebook page? 614-292-8513. And we're getting Kashmir Hill. She's a senior reporter for the Special Projects Desk at Gizmodo. She has looked into this and came across an interesting story of her own regarding a long-lost relative. Again, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm waiting to get reconnected to Kashmir Hill, senior reporter for the Special Projects Desk at Gizmodo. Kashmir, you're there?
I am. Is this any better?
It's a little better. Yeah, great. Thank you so much. So, go ahead.
Sorry about that. But the reason I got interested in people you may know is that I write about privacy and technology. And last year, a father told me that after going to an anonymous meeting for parents with suicidal teens, he saw another one of the fathers pop up in people you may know. And the only thing he could think that they had in common was location. And so I asked Facebook whether location played a role in people you may know, which would have been kind of disturbing because there's many people we come in contact with that we don't actually know that we're around. Mm-hmm. And initially Facebook told me, yes, we use location in people you may know. And then I published a story and an hour later they contacted me and said, no, we don't use location. And so this started this mystery for me about what goes into this. How is Facebook figuring this out? Because I think many users have had kind of disconcerting experiences with that feature, having people pop up and think, I don't understand how Facebook knows I know this person.
Mm-hmm. You wrote that there's something like 100 or so criterion,
yeah.
I should say.
Right. So there's a kind of like a help page on Facebook that tells you how people you may know work and says, here's a few of the things that go into it. It's based on your networks, like if you said what school you're at or your workplace. It's based on the contacts that you've uploaded to Facebook from your phone. But it just gives you about four things that go into it. But when I talked to a spokesperson from Facebook, she said there's over 100 signals that go into people you may know. So this is obviously a very robust tool, and it's very important to Facebook because this is how their network grows. And they found that the more friends a person has, the more they use Facebook. So they want this tool to work well and for you to actually find people you know and expand your network of friends.
So tell us about your experience. You didn't exactly find somebody you know. You found somebody you didn't know that you're related to.
I found somebody I should know.
Yeah.
I started paying close attention to my own Facebook recommendations, friend suggestions, over the summer, And so for 3 months, I just kept track of everybody that came through that tool. And every day, Facebook recommended about 160 people that I should know. Over the course of the summer, they recommended over 1,400 people I should know. And a month into this kind of project, a woman popped up whose last name was Porter, and she lived in Ohio. And I grew up in Florida, but my family's originally from Ohio, and I actually have like a complicated family history where my father's biological father was somebody he didn't know, and he didn't find out about him until adulthood, but his last name was Porter. And so I thought, I wonder if this is a relative. And it seemed like a fair, we didn't have any mutual friends. I didn't know what would have connected us beyond that. But I asked my dad, you know, is this a relative? And he didn't recognize her. And when I sent her a Facebook message, she said, yes, I'm married to my biological grandfather's brother. So Facebook had recommended I friend my great aunt, who I did not know about.
But why? I mean, was it just random, or what did you ever figure it out?
So I don't think it was just random. You know, there's hundreds of millions of Facebook users that they could suggest up to me, and that one was obviously a targeted suggestion. I asked Facebook if they would tell me how they made this connection, and they declined. They said for privacy reasons, and because if they told me, then every time somebody had a strange people you may know suggestion, they would, you know, be obligated to tell that person how their strange connection was made. Mm-hmm. So I still don't know. So I still don't know exactly how they figured this out. The way Facebook makes most of its like creepiest people you may know suggestions is mm-hmm. through contact chaining, where a lot of people hand over their phone address books, for example, to Facebook in order to help them either find people on Messenger or find friends. And so Facebook has this vast collection of many, many, many Americans, many people's contact books. And once you have that, you can kind of figure out who knows each other through, you know, maybe I don't give them my contacts, but if you give them your contacts, mm-hmm. then they'll see that, you know, you emailed me one time for this show, and so they might figure out that we know each other. Or if we both give them our contact books and we both have one person in common, they might think, oh, you know, maybe that person, maybe these people know each other because they have this person in common. And so that, I think, is what leads to a lot of the strangest recommendations is Facebook's insight into the universal contact.
It's sort of like a high-tech 6 degrees of separation, don't you think?
It is. It is exactly that. And one thing that's strange about my aunt, my great aunt and me, is that the people that connect us on Facebook, the people that connect us in the real world aren't on Facebook. My dad's not on Facebook. Her husband's not on Facebook.
Yeah.
All of those, that generation of people are not on Facebook. So I am still mystified by how they were able to connect the two of us, but I think it must be somehow through contact chaining.
Now, you mentioned that Facebook does buy other databases, but they said that they don't use them for this.
Yeah. So Facebook does buy information from data brokers that informs the ads that you see on the network. Mm-hmm. And the one person I talked to who used to work at Facebook said, you know, maybe they're feeding that into the people you may know. But they told me that they don't use information from data brokers for people you may know. So this is still a mystery to me. I'm still trying to figure out what goes into this feature. And so I did, when I published this story, put a call out. And if there's anybody who, among your listeners who knows, I'd love to chat with them.
They won't tell you what those 100 things are that they look at, 100 or plus or whatever it is. They'll only give us a handful publicly. They're afraid that if they do it for one, they'll have to do it for everyone, which is what my parents used to say when we wanted to buy something. But
and it's also for them a proprietary feature. Like, this is a feature also that other
right.
competing social networks have, LinkedIn and Twitter. And so I think they think this is their, you know, their magic algorithm, and they don't want to help out their competitors by saying everything that goes into it.
Is there anything else comparable to that out there?
Anything comparable to
people you may know? Do any other social networking sites?
Yeah.
Okay.
They do. LinkedIn, and they often all call it People You May Know or PYMK.
Uh-huh.
LinkedIn has the same thing. And they also, sometimes people get what they consider to be creepy suggestions on LinkedIn.
Uh-huh.
Twitter has, people you maybe should follow. But that tends to be more interest-based than people you actually know in the real world. So
yeah.
Anecdotally, in my experience, when I've talked to people, they seem to be most disconcerted by the LinkedIn suggestions and the Facebook suggestions, just because it does seem to reflect who they actually know in the real world, and people don't often understand how it is that the social networks figure that out.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from your readers about this story? Have you heard any other interesting stories?
Yeah, I've gotten hundreds of emails from people with their own strange experiences with People You May Know. And some of them, I think, can be explained by what we were talking about earlier of contact books being ingested by Facebook.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't realize that it's not just their own contact books, that the people around them play a big role in their privacy. And so if their friends upload those things, they'll reveal things.
Okay.
So some of the stories are really strange. Other kind of lost family members that have been connected. Some cases where it's really not obvious to me on the surface how Facebook figured out the suggestion. So those are the stories I'm really interested in, and maybe we can figure out how some of those happen, and we can figure out what it's are. So in
Kashmir,
ideal world, I think Facebook would just tell us what the signals are.
Kashmir, we've lost you again. I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Okay, thanks, Anne.
Take care. That's Kashmir Hill. She is a senior reporter for the Special Projects Desk at Gizmodo. We'll have a link to her article about People You May Know, that list on Facebook of people you may know, and what her experience has been. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It was a crime spree across the country that left investigators stumped. Hotels were reporting thefts of TVs, luggage, anything that was in a hotel room, but there were no signs of forced entry or that it was an inside job. The culprit, it turned out, was a security hole in the electronic door locks that thousands of hotels use. It wasn't exactly the culprit, but that's what the culprit used. Joining us now by phone is senior writer for Wired, Andy Greenberg. Andy's story, The Hotel Room Hacker, appears on Wired.com, and we'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Andy Greenberg, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
This was a security vulnerability that was well publicized. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, this story for me began in 2012 when I spoke to a kind of security researcher who had found this vulnerability. And together, we exposed this fact. And he demonstrated to me first that there was a digital vulnerability. And he said 10 million hotel room locks. These are key card locks. But you don't need a key card to get into them. You can build this $50 device that you insert into a little plug on the underside of the lock. And this little device you've built, with just stuff from Radio Shack, can sort of pull out this digital key and open the lock in seconds, in really like a split second. So there is kind of like there are millions of keys hidden under millions of welcome mats in front of hotel rooms around the world, or there were at the time. We worked on. I wrote that story in part to force Onity, the company that makes these locks, to fix the problem,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't. Essentially,
they didn't. And another sort of prodigy picked up on it and brought it out there and told people about it. And then a criminal got a hold of it.
Right. So after I published a news story about this, the security researcher named Cody Brocious, who has found this problem, he published not only an explanation of where the vulnerability was, but even the code that he had used to hack these hotel locks, all in an effort to pressure Onity, the lockmaker, to fix the problem. And even that wasn't enough for them to shell out the cost of fixing it. Instead, they were basically asking hotels to pay for it themselves. And in many cases, hotels, I don't think, even knew about it. So, this went unfixed. And not long after that, an actual criminal hacker named Aaron Kashat discovered the problem, basically followed the instructions on the security researcher's website, built the tool, and started a really epic hotel room hacking spree across the country.
Tell us a little bit about that. And it went on. He was kind of a career. I don't know if career criminal is the right word to use or not. He certainly became one.
Well, Aaron Kashat was a methamphetamine addict. He had been in prison twice before. He had, he was technically skilled to a certain degree, but he had used his talents for, things like hacking people's Wi-Fi to steal their tax return and, do some petty fraud. And he'd even hacked the breathalyzer in his car after he had a felony DUI. So, just so that he could basically drive drunk and the breathalyzer was bypassed. So he had these skills, and he was, I guess you could say, a career criminal, on and off. But he had kind of he had kind of gone straight in this point in his life. But then he was hit with a felony DUI that was going to send him to prison anyway. And so he decided that he had nothing to lose, and he might as well, go on the run, hack as many hotel rooms as possible. He hinted to me that he had hit more than 100 burglaries across the country.
Yeah, he got a group of people together, a revolving group of people, to help him sell the stuff, gather it. His house was filled with it eventually, or his apartment.
Right. So he kind of honed this little tool that he fit into an Oakley sunglasses case with a little on and off button hidden in the O of the Oakley brand, and he could just insert it into the bottom of the lock and open it. And he really practiced this till he was able to do these operations. Like, police described him as a ghost. There was just no trace. And he would just empty rooms, just really grab everything that belonged to guests, throw it into their own luggage, and wheel it up a back exit. And he amassed, by some measures, close to $500,000 worth of stuff, which he, would just fence through friends. And it included, uncountable iPads and laptops and phones, but also things like, custom signed guitars and guns, an airline pilot's uniform, and a pilot's license. Just a really bizarre collection of stuff that he ended up with.
And when he was doing this and using this device to hack the locks, nobody knew what he was doing. They knew things were being stolen, but they didn't know how he was
right.
Getting in the room.
Certainly when he started this in Arizona, which is where he's from, the Arizona police were completely stumped. I mean, they could just see that there was no sign of forced entry. If you analyze the forensics of the lock, it looked like someone had used this device that belongs to the hotels as a kind of master key to get in. So it seemed like it must be the staff that was stealing stuff. But staff doesn't, generally take TVs off of the walls of multiple rooms, because that's something else that Aaron did.
But, I still wonder how he got away with just lugging so much junk out. I mean, if I walked out with a TV, I think somebody would notice.
So that's what he did at first. He would, put TVs, wrap them in the sheets in the room and with blankets and carry them out a back door. I think he then realized that he could more easily impersonate a hotel guest. And so he and his friend would just walk in the front door, nonchalantly stroll in, and then stroll out back wheeling suitcases. And they didn't look any different from any other guest. In fact, he would often encounter hotel staff, and he said that he would just kind of play it cool, and they would treat him deferentially, like they would any guest.
then I think about all the cameras everywhere, why there was a pattern wasn't didn't evolve out of that, because he dressed the same way all the time.
Right. There was certainly a pattern forming, but he, you know, he wore this white fedora. This was the pattern. He wore this white fedora everywhere he would go, and he said, as long as I don't look up, the cameras are up, and if I'm wearing this white fedora, they can't see my face. And that worked, essentially. They did eventually, police sent out like an alert with, pictures of him in his white fedora, but they didn't initially know his identity. And eventually, once they did find his identity, they were able to get access to his Facebook page and find even like photos of him wearing this white fedora. And that was kind of the beginning of the end for Aaron Gishat's crime spree.
I get that the lot company didn't want to have to do this because deal with this because it was just going to cost him money. But what about the hotels? What do you understand about why they weren't more concerned about this issue?
Well, I think a lot of the hotels initially didn't know. Mm-hmm. Then they were fighting with Onady about who would pay. It cost about $25 a lock to fix. And then Onady sort of came up with this cheap solution, this kind of Band-Aid, where they would send them these little plastic plugs that you could just put into that hole on the bottom of the lock. Mm-hmm. But Aaron figured out how to take those out, and he could do the whole process
within
with a special
like 20 seconds.
In about 20 seconds. So that fix failed. And so this gave him enough time that for about a year, he was really able to carry out his crime. I think now hotels have figured this out. And, as I wrote in the story, I recreated the hotel lock hacking device and tried it, around New York City. And I found that it didn't work most of the time, which mm-hmm. is good news. I think hotels finally have, for the most part, figured this out. But in one case, it did work. So there are still hotels out there that haven't fixed this problem, even now, it seems.
So a lot of the high-end hotel rooms you went to, they were secure, but maybe this last place you mentioned, not so fancy?
That's true. And also, I think it's more of a question of what franchise it is. I mean, if it's a higher budget place, it's more likely to be fixed. And if it's part of a big franchise of hotels, they seem to have gotten the message. But if it's more of a mom-and-pop place, then they may not have. I mean, they may not have been alerted. Onady did eventually, concede and pay for the fixes for some of its biggest customers, too. And those are like, the big chains. But if you're staying in some kind of one-off place in the middle of America, mm-hmm. it still might be vulnerable.
And what does this say? This mistake happened once. They've corrected it in many places. Could it happen again?
Well, I cover security, and I have for many years, and I have to say, I assume that if a talented hacker like the security researcher who exposed this problem looks at most hotel locks, I bet that they can be broken. And Cody Brocious, the security researcher who found this Onity flaw, told me at the time that he believed that there probably were similar flaws in practically every major hotel lock vendor, but he happened to stumble across this one only because he was working for a startup that was trying to create its own sort of alternative to Onity's system, and they were reverse engineering the competitor's stuff and found this flaw. So, mm-hmm. there's nothing to say that Onity is really any more vulnerable than the other companies. And in fact, they at least have fixed one known problem, whereas these other major keycard locks, they haven't really been examined as far as we know.
Now, as far as the actual mechanics, the last hotel I stayed in, you just wave the card in front of a scanner. You don't insert it into anything. Is that different? Does that matter?
Well, I like I said, I haven't done it. I haven't even found security researchers who have properly audited these other locks. So I don't know what kind of security they might have.
Okay.
But in Onity's case, it wasn't. Even it had nothing to do with the card. You didn't need a card. You didn't touch the kind of poster vertical slot that you stick that card into. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to counterfeit a card. It was all in the fact that there was this little port in the bottom of the lock that would look like a DC power port. But in fact, it was a data port that the hotel could use to send a command to open the lock in case the lock ran out of battery. They could power it up through that hole and send it an open command, and it functioned as a kind of skeleton key for the hotel, and they could cassettes, which locks worked with which master key with this thing called a portable programmer that was plugged into that port.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's basically what these hackers were taking advantage of. They were recreating that portable programmer, the sort of back door into all these locks. And it had nothing to do with the front door, the key card that you and I would use to open the lock.
Whose fault is this? I mean, does a cybersecurity researcher who revealed all of this, does he share any of the blame? But that's pretty typical for cybersecurity people to reveal and then the company fixes.
Right. I mean, that's this beat that I cover is very often about, security researchers exposing a problem like this to pressure the company to fix it. And it's a responsible thing to do in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it didn't work and it backfired massively. Maybe the security researcher shouldn't have published code to allow someone to exploit this. But maybe that was part of how you pressure Onity, who was so, recalcitrant and refused to fix it. That's how you pressure them to finally do it when anyone can show. And there were, after that code was published, there were multiple TV news segments about this to show that that vulnerability is there and to really, mount, to put on the pressure.
I kind of wonder if Aaron, is it Cashett?
Mm-hmm.
If he developed any new technology in office, because he worked really hard to streamline it.
Well, I think I wouldn't say that he invented anything, but he did certainly, incrementally improve the tool that the security researcher created.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually it was a very slick little device. And in fact, before the security researcher who showed this to me, before we went public with it, he took me around to three hotels around New York and we tried it. And it only actually worked in one out of three cases.
Mm-hmm.
So it was after that initial release that other hackers started to refine it. And, by the time that Aaron Cashett was using it to rob places, it did work, and he said like 19 out of 20 times. It was very reliable.
Did he ever feel any guilt? To me, it was kind of like taking candy from a baby, right?
Well, he was in a very particular state of mind that was induced by methamphetamines, and he was staying up for days on end. He described to me how like he would see these shadow people in the corners of his vision during this time in his life, and meth essentially just eradicated his conscience. So I don't think he felt any remorse about it. I think he does now. Aaron is in prison now, and I visited him there and spoke with him, and he definitely says that he's ready for a new life when he gets out. He's sworn off crime. He's sworn off drugs. He doesn't even smoke anymore. He would like to work in the security industry like many other reformed hackers and con artists. I suppose I believe him when he says that he does feel regret about this.
There are a lot like him in the business too, right? I mean, that is what a lot of them end up doing. They go into the business of security.
If you talk to most, I would say, talented security researchers in the industry, they at least had some kind of teenage flirtation with criminal hacking or at least illegal exploration. I wouldn't say most of them have gone on this kind of
this kind of
100-plus burglary bender. Yeah.
Has anyone set a value at how much he stole?
I have heard he hinted to me that it was in the hundreds of thousands. I have other reasons to believe it's closer to $500,000. It's tough to say. I don't think he made that much, regardless, because he was then selling it for pennies on the dimes on the dollar. He was just one guy, but it's just like usually when hackers are stealing money, they're kind of anonymously or without any sort of hands-on connection, taking millions of dollars with credit cards or other digital theft. But this was, he actually had his hands on all of these goods and physically robbed each one of these hotel rooms himself or with a friend. So it was a kind of manual labor of hotel hacking.
Andy Greenberg, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, it's fun to be here. Thanks.
That's Andy Greenberg. He's a senior writer for Wired. We'll have a link to his article about Aaron Cashett and how he hacked so many hotel locks across the country. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last Friday was a happy day for Star Wars superfans. September 1st was Force Friday, an event where all kinds of new Star Wars swag is released into the wild. Joining us now to talk about the latest Star Wars gadgets and other tech news is contributing editor for Android Central, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Actually, now that I come to think of it, there was a lot of Star Wars stuff out there, but I didn't know it was a day.
Yeah, it's one of those things that just kind of appears, you know, and it's this bizarre coordinated effort by Disney where it's not just the toys are on shelves, but there are big displays that with very little warning are just kind of in the store all of a sudden on Force Friday. It's kind of fascinating.
You can fly some of your Star Wars ships now in drone form?
This is something that they've been working on for a couple of years now, where there's been, you know, little quadcopters and drones in kind of toy form in order to make it so that you can fly the Millennium Falcon and the kind of speeder bikes and some of the others. They've been in stores for a little while, but these drones from Propel actually take things up a notch by making them combat drones that you can play laser tag against your friends with. So you have a speeder bike, a TIE advanced fighter, and an X-Wing fighter, and you can just fly them around like normal drones, or you and your friends, who obviously also have these $129 drones, can play laser tag with one another with these drones, where you're flying them around one another and shooting each other with the goal of knocking the other drone out of the sky.
Yeah, all right. So it gets knocked out of the sky, and then it breaks?
Well, they're actually designed to pretty safely land on the ground. I kind of tried to break one over the weekend by crashing it into stuff and by letting it drop from pretty tall heights. And it's got some intelligence in it to make sure that it's landing as safely as possible. So I was unable to break the one that I had here, which almost made me sad.
Once again, Dad of the Year Award. Did you let your kids play with them?
Oh, yeah. They've been delighted to see the different drones. And it's funny that, you know, the big push for Force Friday is the toys that are leading up to the next movie that's coming out. With the first time they did this, it was leading up to The Force Awakens and now for The Last Jedi. But these drones don't actually have anything to do with those new movies. These are classic Star Wars vehicles, you know, from the original movie. So it's really not just targeted at these new movies, but really just the entire Star Wars franchise in general.
How big are they?
They fit in the palm of your hand. They're not very big at all. They're designed to be flown indoors and outdoors with some intelligence to help with both. And they have this really intricate training program built into the app that you use on your phone to drive these to kind of teach you how to fly before the drone is even turned on. It uses a virtual drone in the app that you fly around to kind of get the basics of flying before you actually go and slam this thing at 30 miles an hour into a wall.
$129 a piece. Do you think they're fairly priced?
I think they're fairly priced for what you're getting, as long as you have friends in the area who you're going to play with. And that's kind of the idea here, is that this is really one of the first drones that I've seen that's designed for multiplayer use. It's not, you know, you can just own the one, or you can have three friends and you can all actually, up to 12 people can play together in kind of larger combat things.
Oh, geez. Okay. There is also a Star Wars themed augmented reality game. Tell us about Star Wars Jedi Challenges.
Yeah, so this is a special augmented reality headset that you put on your head that looks very similar to a lot of the virtual reality headsets that are out there, except it's transparent in the front. You plug your phone into this headset and pick up a handle, a lightsaber, and you can have lightsaber battles with Kylo Ren and Darth Vader and you know, several other iconic figures you would want to, you know, swing a lightsaber at until they fell down. As well as the Jedi challenges for strategy, you know, making sure that that your planets aren't overrun by the First Order. And if you are a fan of that from the original movie, you can play a game of holo chess against a computer opponent.
So you need the headset, but what else? Do you need any, you know, do you need a lightsaber or anything? Or
the headset, the kit, it's $199, and it comes with the headset, a tracker that sits out in front of you, and the lightsaber. And they all three work together to make all of this work and feel realistic as you're going and swinging a lightsaber around, hopefully by yourself. Please don't hit anybody with this thing.
You can build your own droid now. There's a Star Wars droid inventor kit. Now, this is different from the little Star Wars fighter drones.
This is actually an extension of a very kid-friendly kind of engineer platform called Littlebits. And Littlebits has been around for a while, where you can build custom alarm clocks and sensors for your room, and it's very child-focused to kind of teach them the basics of engineering and wiring and circuit board assembly and things like that. And Littlebits partnered with Disney to create an entire R2-D2 kit, where you can essentially build your own R2-D2, and they've extended that so you can actually build several different droids. You can even build one that is of your own design and not just a clone of one of the ones from the Star Wars universe, but you can go through and really kind of understand the basics of, you know, I need to put this chip here in order for the sound to work correctly. I need to put this chip here in order for the motor to work correctly. And each one of these little, pieces kind of all come together around the casing to form a very bizarre kind of transparent looking R2-D2 that you can then drive around and give instruction to.
What are the age ranges for these different toys or these different kits?
A lot of the stuff that I've seen so far is pretty clearly geared towards, adults, you know, the 20s and 30s, but the Littlebits is definitely geared towards 8 and up. Something that, you know, a kid can sit down either with or without a parent and you know, kind of work on these things. Now, that's not to say that, you know, kids in the, you know, 15 to 18 range wouldn't love to get their hands on these drones or some of the other robots that are available. They're just priced out of what they would usually be able to afford on their own. So they've covered a pretty wide age range.
Well, now I know that you probably enjoy all of this, but all things being equal, what do you make of these ad blitzes, these big marketing blitzes? Are they worth it? Are they necessary? Is it just a natural?
You know, it's one of those things that it almost doesn't matter what I think, because I remember 2 years ago when The Force Awakens came out. And by the time the movie had come out, every single thing was Star Wars. There was Star Wars, cookies that you could make in the oven at my grocery store. There were bags of oranges that had
that's
Star
right.
Wars
I forgot about that.
You know, so really, you know, this is just kind of the start. This is basically Disney saying Star Wars season is back. We're not even going to call this holiday shopping anymore. It's Star Wars season, because it's going to be from now until the middle of December, and The Last Jedi finally hit theaters.
Well, I'll tell you what, if it's as half as, well, not even, I mean, hopefully it's as good as The Force Awakens, because I can't wait.
Absolutely.
All right. YouTube is stepping up its live TV offerings to compete in the world of streaming television. We're familiar with YouTube, you know, but what's YouTube TV? What's the difference?
YouTube TV is a subscription service that is live television. This isn't, you know, this is the YouTube app that you are already using with kind of secondary features that allow you to check out live television across, most of your basic cable channels in 41 different markets right now across the U.S., where it's, you know, streaming video, and it can either be on your phone or on your tablet or on your laptop, or you can Chromecast it to your television. This is really kind of competing with a lot of the other streaming television services we've seen so far, PlayStation Now and Slingbox and some of these other services that have been available. This is just, you know, it's more convenient because it's available, you know, through YouTube. And the big thing that has happened recently is that, you know, there are now a pretty significant chunk of the United States is now able to use YouTube TV, where when they first announced it, it was really only a couple of cities.
What are they going to, what's going to set it apart?
The big thing that YouTube is using to set it apart is a cloud DVR service that almost has no limitations. You know, this is, if you're, you know, instead of having a DVR in your home, or paying for cable, the idea here is that you would pay, YouTube TV, the monthly subscription fee for that. And then when you want to record something that you would then watch later, you would record it and it would basically save it to your YouTube account, not like a YouTube video that you uploaded, but to your Google account, and be able to watch it from anything, you know, from your phones and any different setup like that.
Is there a competition for that?
It's a massive competition right now across the different services that are offering the ability to stream television. And that's the biggest feature that they're using to compete for a lot of these services is what happens when I want to watch something later. You know, mm-hmm. there are a couple that'll say you can record, two shows at the same time, but you only have 10 gigabytes of storage that you can keep an eye on. There are some that, you know, have an unlimited amount of storage. You can only record one show at a time. Or when you do record a show, it's only in standard definition instead of high definition. And YouTube TV is really trying to set themselves apart by making it so that, you know, you're paying $35 a month. And through that, you can record just an enormous amount of television through what they're calling cloud DVR. And you have access to all of the basic channels that you would get with basic cable, but definitely not all of them. It's what you would expect for about $30 worth of television service.
Everything but the sports.
You get, well, it's everything but the sports, and then, you know, some things like Comedy Central and Cartoon Network and some of the other, kind of not quite basic cable, but in that same area.
Mm-hmm.
But you do, you know, get ABC and CBS and Disney and all of those channels. Just and you do get some sports. They have ESPN and Fox Sports. And I think there's NBC Golf, which was a weird thing to toss in there. But I'm not going to judge. People really like golf. So.
And you said it's pretty much available. Everyone can pretty much get YouTube now.
It's not quite everywhere, but okay. They've expanded to something like 41 different markets now with a lot of different areas. Columbus, for example, just got access to it. Washington, D.C. And Baltimore just got access to it. There are a lot of different areas, and they're updating pretty frequently.
So who are they shooting for? Is it the larger market, or is there a niche here, or what?
I think ultimately, you know, Google as a company wants to be able to show that all you really need in your home is an internet connection.
Mm-hmm.
That this could be, you know, kind of an alternative to cable, and not in the same way that cable cutters have been using like Hulu and Netflix and Amazon. Like, this is live streaming television that is already a part of your Google experience is what I think they're hoping for.
And so I guess the major competition is cable and satellite, right?
It's cable and satellite, and then, you know, these other streaming services, they are also getting better all the time. So it's kind of fascinating that by the end of the year, there will be just a ton of options for people who aren't quite interested in paying for cable anymore.
You know, now the reason why I go to Netflix or Hulu or any of those is because of their original programming.
Absolutely, and that's something that we've seen Netflix in particular has kind of doubled down on, making sure that they have just a ton of original programming all the time to keep people sticking around.
Mm-hmm. There is some news from Amazon's line of Echo smart speakers. They can work with each other to fill multiple rooms now. I don't know that was new. I thought we talked about that before.
This is something Google Home has had access to, but Amazon has not had access to and it's been kind of a pain point. To see this was something that Amazon was kind of the first out of the box with, the ability to play music in your home with just kind of this little hockey puck that was only $35 that you could connect to whatever speaker you wanted, but they didn't talk to each other.
Uh-huh.
And so there's been an update that rolled out last week that finally allows that to happen. You have to use the Amazon app to basically link the things together that you want to play at the same time. But once you do that, you can now listen to the streaming music that you would normally listen to from a single Echo. You can fill your house with.
And this is obviously it's not a big advantage to Amazon. It's putting them on an even playing field, right?
Right. This is just, you know, at the point of competing with Google Home, which is an important thing because Google Home is still considerably more expensive than Amazon Echo's Dot, system. That $35, you know, connected home accessory that you can put anywhere and very small was a big competing point for Amazon, especially through the holiday season last year. They sold just a tremendous number of them. But it was something, if you cared about music, the Google Home system was still a better system. And so now they're back to this kind of this level playing field with the kind of leaning advantage that they're still, you know, outpricing Google by a lot.
I don't think we've talked about Amazon buying Whole Foods. What do you make of that?
I've never been in a Whole Foods before.
You're kidding me.
So I don't know. And there's one like 35 minutes from me, and I've been considering going just because you're the fifth person to have that reaction when I say that I've never been to a Whole Foods.
Well, if they're 35 minutes away, I wouldn't go 35 minutes. So
right. But I feel like I'm missing something. And the one thing that I did see was really interesting was the day that the deal was official and public, Amazon had not only the price cuts that everyone was excited about for Whole Foods, but also they had tables in every single Whole Foods that were filled with Amazon Echo and Amazon Echo Dot speakers for people to buy. It had never been available in those stores before.
Oh, I haven't been in since then.
Yeah, Amazon from day one started pushing the Amazon Echo service inside the physical Whole Foods stores. And they haven't released any information about how many have been sold, but that would be really interesting information to get a hold of.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, we have a few more minutes left, and you recently wrote some tips about how to avoid some of the motion sickness some people experience when they're trying out virtual reality games. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So this is something that ends up being really important for people who, you know, this is one of the first things that I ask for someone who's trying VR for the first time is how comfortable are you with things like motion sickness? Is that something, if you're on a boat, are you just, you know, you're like constantly staring at the horizon because you feel like you're going to get sick? Because I have friends like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's every single virtual reality platform has some version of comfort ratings in the listing of the apps that are available. And the comfort ratings are there specifically for people that are easily nauseated by just about anything. If they don't, you know, if being on kind of a shaky platform makes them uneasy, then you really want to pay attention to the comfort ratings of the apps, because there are some that are, you know, not any problems at all. You're in virtual reality and you're moving blocks around and you're doing things, and it's, you know, a very positive experience. And then there are others where you are flying a ship in space and gravity doesn't really exist, and your brain can't handle that because it knows that you're physically standing in a room somewhere. And so all of a sudden you need to tear the headset off and find a restroom. So knowing those differences is really significant.
What else? Just that?
The other thing is, if you're, that's like the big thing for starting.
Okay.
You know, the next really important thing, once you're in a headset, if you feel like it's going to be a problem, almost every app that has a lot of problems, almost every app that has a lot of wild motion maintains a virtual version of the horizon line. So just like being on a boat, if you find that horizon line and you stare at it, it's kind of a focus point for your brain that will help kind of center yourself, and that often helps deal a lot with nausea.
Russell Holley, thanks again. As always, appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holley is a contributing editor for Android Central, a regular here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to 89.7 NPR News.